Chapter 5. Haversacks, what a grouping of bronzed energetic heads about the packed tables in the restaurant. It is not easy for civilians to get to Chalens, and almost every table is occupied by officers and soldiers for, once off duty, there seems to be no rank distinction in this happy democratic army, and the simple private, if he chooses to treat himself to the excellent fare of the haute mere dieu, has as good a right to it as his colonel. The scene in the restaurant is inexhaustibly interesting. The mere attempt to puzzle out the different uniforms is absorbing. A week's experience near the front convinces me that no two uniforms in the French army are alike either in color or in cut. Within the last 2 years, the question of color has greatly preoccupied the French military authorities, who have been seeking an invisible blue, and the range of their experiments is proved by the extraordinary variety of shades of blue, ranging from a sort of grayish robin's egg to the darkest navy, in which the army is clothed. The result attained is the conviction that no blue is really inconspicuous, and that some of the harsh new slaty tints are no less striking than the deeper shades they have superseded. But to this scale of experimental blues, other colors must be added. The poppy red of the Spahis's tunics, and various other less familiar colors gray, and a certain greenish khaki, the use of which is due to the fact that the cloth supply has given out, and that all available materials are employed. As for the differences in cut, the uniforms vary from the old tight tunic to the loose belted jacket copied from the English, and the emblems of the various arms and ranks embroidered on these diversified habits add a new element of perplexity. The aviator's wings, the motorist's wheel, and many of the newer symbols are easily recognizable, but there are all the other arms, and the doctors and the stretcher bearers, the sappers and miners, and heaven knows how many more ramifications of this great host which is really all the nation. The main interest of the scene, however, is that it shows almost as many types as uniforms, and that almost all the types are so good. One begins to understand, if one has failed to before, why the French say of themselves, La France est une nation guerrière. War is the greatest of paradoxes. The most senseless and disheartening of human retrogressions, and yet the stimulant of qualities of soul which, in every race, can seemingly find no other means of renewal. Everything depends, therefore, on the category of impulses that war excites in a people. Looking at the faces at Chalens, one sees at once in which, page 54, since the French are une nation guerrière. It is not too much to say that war has given beauty to faces that were interesting, humorous, acute, malicious, 100 vivid and expressive things, but last and least of all beautiful. Almost all the faces about these crowded tables, young or old, plain or handsome, distinguished or average, have the same look of quiet authority. It is as though all nervosity, fussiness, little personal oddities, meannesses, and vulgarities had been burnt away in a great flame of self-dedication. It is a wonderful example of the rapidity with which purpose models the human countenance. More than half of these men were probably doing dull, or useless or unimportant things till the 1st of last August. Now each one of them, however small his job, is sharing in a great task, and knows it, and has been made over by knowing it. Our road on leaving Chalens continued to run northeastward toward the hills of the Argonne. We passed through more deserted villages, with soldiers lounging in the doors, where old women should have sat with their distaffs, soldiers watering their horses in the village pond, soldiers cooking over gypsy fires in the farmyards. In the patches of woodland along the road we came upon more soldiers, cutting down pine saplings, chopping them into even lengths and loading them on hand carts, with the green boughs piled on top. We soon saw to what use they were put, for at every crossroad or railway bridge a warm sentry box of mud and straw, and plaited pine branches was plastered against a bank, or tucked like a swallow's nest into a sheltered corner. A little farther on we began to come more and more frequently on big colonies of Aventi-5s. drawn up nose to nose, usually against a curtain of woodland, in a field at some distance from the road, and always attended by a cumbrous drove of motor vans. They looked like giant gazelles feeding among elephants, and the stables of woven pine boughs which stood nearby might have been the huge huts of their herdsmen. The country between Marne and Meuse is one of the regions on which German fury spent itself most bestially during the abominable September days. Halfway between Chalons and St. Menehould we came on the first evidence of the invasion, the lamentable ruins of the village of Auve. These pleasant villages of the Aisne, with their one long street, their half-timbered houses and high-roofed granaries with espaliered gable ends, are all much of one pattern, and one can easily picture what Auve must have been as it looked out, in the blue September weather, above the ripening pears of its gardens to the crops, in the valley and the large landscape beyond. Now it is a mere waste of rubble, page 58, and cinders, not one threshold distinguishable from another. We saw many other ruined villages after Auve, but this was the first, and perhaps for that reason one had there, most hauntingly, the vision of all the separate terrors, anguishes, uprootings and rendings apart involved in the destruction of the obscurest of human communities. The photographs on the walls, the twigs of withered box above the crucifixes, the old wedding dresses in brass clamp trunks, the bundles of letters laboriously written, and as painfully deciphered, all the thousand and one bits of the past, that give meaning and continuity to the present of all that accumulated warmth, nothing was left, but a brick heap and some twisted stove pipes. As we ran on toward St. Menehould, the names on our map showed us that, just beyond the parallel range of hills 6 or 7 miles to the north, the two armies lay interlocked. But we heard no cannon yet, and the first visible evidence of the nearness of the struggle was the encounter, at a bend of the road, of a long line of gray-coated figures tramping toward us between the bayonets of their captors. They were a sturdy lot, this fresh pack from the hills, of a fine fighting age, and much less famished, and more worn than one could have wished. Their broad blonde faces were meaningless, guarded, but neither defiant nor unhappy. They seemed none too sorry for their fate. Our pass from the general headquarters carried us to St. Menehould on the edge of the Argonne, where we had to apply to the headquarters of the division for a farther extension. The staff are lodged in a house considerably the worse for German occupancy, where offices have been improvised by means of wooden hoardings, and where, sitting in a bare passage on a frayed damask sofa surmounted by theatrical posters, and faced by a bed with a plum-colored counterpane, we listened for a while to the jingle of telephones, the rat-tat of typewriters, the steady hum of dictation and the coming and going of hurried dispatch-bearers and orderlies. The extension to the permit was presently delivered with the courteous request that we should push on to Verdun as fast as possible, as civilian motors were not wanted on the road that afternoon. And this request, coupled with the evident stir of activity at headquarters, gave us the impression that there must be a good deal happening beyond the low line of hills to the north. How much there was we were soon to know. We left St. Menehould at about 11, and before 12 o'clock we were nearing a large village on a ridge from which the land swept away to right and left in ample reaches. The first glimpse of the outlying houses showed nothing unusual, but presently the main street turned and dipped downward, and below and beyond us lay a long stretch of ruins. The calcined remains of Clermont en Argonne, destroyed by the Germans on the 4th of September. The free and lofty situation of the little town, for it was really a good deal more than a village, makes its present state the more lamentable. One can see it from so far off, and through the torn traceries of its ruined church the eye travels over so lovely a stretch of country. No doubt its beauty enriched the joy of wrecking it. At the farther end of what was once the main street another small knot of houses has survived. Chief among them is the Hospice for Old Men, where Sister Gabrielle Rosnet, when the authorities of Clermont took to their heels, stayed behind to defend her charges, and where, ever since, she has nursed an undiminishing stream of wounded from the Eastern Front. We found Sieur Rosnet, with her sisters, preparing the midday meal of her patients in the little kitchen of the hospice. The kitchen which is also her dining room and private office. She insisted on our finding time to share the filet and fried potatoes that were just being taken off the stove, and while we lunched she told us the story of the invasion of the hospice doors broken down, coups de grace, and the gray officers bursting in with revolvers, and finding her there before them, in the big vaulted vestibule, alone with my old men and my sisters. Sieur Gabrielle Rosnet is a small, round, active woman, with a shrewd and ruddy face of the type that looks out calmly from the dark background of certain Flemish pictures. Her blue eyes are full of warmth and humor, and she puts as much gaiety as wrath into her tale. She does not spare epithets in talking of S. Satin's elements. These sisters and nurses of the front have seen sights to dry up the last drop of sentimental pity, but through all the horror of those fierce September days, with Clermont blazing about her, and the helpless remnant of its inhabitants under the perpetual threat of massacre, she retained her sense of the little inevitable absurdities of life, such as her not knowing how to address the officer in command because he was so tall that I couldn't see up to his shoulder straps. T.L.Z.A. in Taus com circa, she added, a sort of reluctant admiration in her eyes. A subordinate sister had just cleared the table and poured out our coffee when a woman came in to say, in a matter-of-fact tone, that there was hard fighting going on across the valley. She added calmly, as she dipped our plates into a tub, that an obus had just fallen a mile or two off, and that if we liked we could see the fighting from a garden over the way. It did not take us long to reach that garden. Sieur Gabrielle showed the way, bouncing up the stairs of a house across the street, and flying at her heels we came out on a grassy terrace full of soldiers. The cannon were booming without a pause, and seemingly so near, that it was bewildering to look out across empty fields at a hillside that seemed like any other. But luckily somebody had a field glass, and with its help a little corner of the Battle of Vaucluse was suddenly brought close to us. The rush of French infantry up the slopes, the feathery drift of French gun smoke lower down, and, high up, on the wooded crest along the sky, the red lightnings and white puffs of the German artillery. Rap, 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 went the answering guns, as the troops swept up and disappeared into the fire-tongued wood. And we stood there dumbfounded at the accident of having stumbled on this visible episode of the great subterranean struggle. Though Sieur Rosnet had seen too many such sights to be much moved, she was full of a lively curiosity, and stood beside us, squarely planted in the mud, holding the field glass to her eyes, or passing it laughingly about among the soldiers. But as we turned to go she said, "Colin, they've sent us word to be ready for another 400 tonight," and the twinkle died out of her good eyes. Her expectations were to be dreadfully surpassed, for, as we learned a fortnight later from a three-column communique, the scene we had assisted at was no less than the first act of the successful assault on the high-perched village of Vaucluse, a point of the first importance to the Germans, since it masked their operations to the north of Varennes, and commanded the railway by which, since September, they have been revictualling and reinforcing their army in the Argonne. Vaucluse had been taken by them at the end of September, and, thanks to its strong position on a rocky spur, had been almost impregnably fortified. But the attack we looked on at from the Garden of Clermont, on Sunday, February 28th, carried the victorious French troops to the top of the ridge, and made them masters of a part of the village. Driven from it again that night, they were to retake it after a five-day struggle of exceptional violence and prodigal heroism, and are now securely established there in a position described as of vital importance to the operations. Be but what it cost, Sieur Gabrielle said, when we saw her again a few days later. 2. The time had come to remember our promise and hurry away from Clermont. But a few miles farther our attention was arrested by the sight of the Red Cross over a village house. The house was little more than a hovel, the village lurker that was called a mere hamlet of scattered cottages and cow stables. A place so easily overlooked, that it seemed likely our supplies might be needed there. An orderly went to find the medicine chef, and we waded after him through the mud to one after another of the cottages in which, with admirable ingenuity, he had managed to create out of next to nothing the indispensable requirements of a second-line ambulance. Sterilizing and disinfecting appliances, a bandage room, a pharmacy, a well-filled woodshed, and a clean kitchen in which icens were brewing over a cheerful fire. A detachment of cavalry was quartered in the village, which the trampling of hoofs had turned into a great morass, and as we picked our way from cottage to cottage in the doctor's wake, he told us of the expedients to which he had been put to secure even the few hovels into which his patients were crowded. It was a complaint we were often to hear repeated along this line of the front, where troops and wounded are packed in thousands into villages meant to house 400 or 500, and we admired the skill and devotion with which he had dealt with the difficulty, and managed to lodge his patients decently. We came back to the high road, and he asked us if we should like to see the church. It was about 3 o'clock, and in the low porch the cure was ringing the bell for vespers. We pushed open the inner doors and went in. The church was without aisles, and down the nave stood 4 rows of wooden cots with brown blankets. In almost every one lay a soldier, the doctor's horse cases, few of them wounded, the greater number stricken with fever, bronchitis, frostbite, pleurisy, or some other form of trench sickness too severe to permit of their being carried farther from the front. One or two heads turned on the pillows as we entered, but for the most part the men did not move. The cure, meanwhile, passing around to the sacristy, had come out before the altar in his vestments, followed by a little white acolyte. A handful of women, probably the only evil inhabitants left, and some of the soldiers we had seen about the village, had entered the church and stood together between the rows of cots, and the service began. It was a sunless afternoon, and the picture was all in monastic shades of black and white and ash and gray. The sick under their earth-colored blankets, their livid faces against the pillows, the black dresses of the women, they seemed all to be in mourning, and the silver haze floating out from the little acolyte's censer. The only light in the scene, the candle gleams on the altar, and their reflection in the embroideries of the cure's chasuble were like a faint streak of sunset on the winter dusk. For a while the long Latin cadences sounded on through the church. But presently the cure took up in French the Canticle of the Sacred Heart, composed during the War of 1870, and the little congregation joined their trembling voices in the refrain. Sauvez, sauvez la France, ni l'abandonnez pas. The reiterated appeal rose in a sob above the rows of bodies in the nave. Sauvez, sauvez la France, the women wailed it near the altar, the soldiers took it up from the door in stronger tones. But the bodies in the cots never stirred, and more, as the day faded, the church looked like a quiet graveyard in a battlefield. After we had left St. Menehould, the sense of the nearness and all-pervadingness of the war became even more vivid. Every road branching away to our left was a finger touching a red wound. Varennes, La Fort de Paris, La Boisse de la Grurie were not more than 8 or 10 miles to the north. Along our own road the stream of motor vans and the trains of ammunition grew longer and more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.